Good morning. A Saturday morning here in America and Saturday afternoon in Europe, where our reporters are at their microphones. And to get the news from the Scandinavian countries, we switch you to Stockholm, Sweden.
Hello, NBC. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. Finally, the tension which has been prevalent in these northern capitals for the past 2 months has been broken. Finland is now in war with Great Britain. Late yesterday afternoon, it was known here in Stockholm that the Finnish reply was being sent through the Finnish legation in Washington. But at that time, the terms of that answer were not known. This morning, however, I'm in a position to outline for you some of the main points in this Finnish reply. In the first place, the note said that Finland could see no conflict of interest between herself, Great Britain, or the United States. She was not menacing the Murmansk Railway. Secondly, in the Finnish reply to the United States note, Finland tried to indicate to America that she was ready to lay down her arms soon. The Finns were not in the position to indicate this in so many words, but they had hoped that America would understand this meaning from the tone of the reply. Thirdly, the Finns have no written agreement with the Germans, and hence it is impossible for them to enter into such a written agreement with the United States or Great Britain. Fourthly, as far as Finland's joining the Anti-Comintern Pact is concerned, Finland's position, as regards her relation to the other Pact members, is based on Foreign Minister Whiting's preamble to that pact. This preamble is divided into 3 points. First, Finland's position is based on her past independent history. Secondly, Finland will not tolerate any interference in her internal affairs. Thirdly, Finland will not enter into any political agreements. The Finnish reply ends by saying that she would deeply regret if Great Britain found it necessary to declare a state of war. This morning here in Stockholm, some hope was still held that Britain would find a formal declaration of war unnecessary. Even after the Reuters message was issued late last night to the effect that a state of war actually existed between Great Britain on the one hand, Finland, Hungary, and Romania on the other, there was still the opinion here, at least, that this might not be final. If we refer to the Reuters message of last night, it seems highly possible, from its wording, that this declaration of war had been issued before the Finnish reply had reached the British capital. I spoke to several high diplomatic sources a little less than an hour ago, and there seems to be a volley of confusion as to the authenticity of Great Britain's formal declaration of war. 2 hours ago, however, BBC announced that this formal message had already been sent to the three countries. Finnish diplomatic sources here, up to an hour ago, had heard nothing about whether this message had reached Helsinki. Despite the uncertainty here surrounding the proceedings for this formal declaration of war, the BBC report must be taken as conclusive evidence that the Finns will, in the course of the next few hours, technically be in a state of war with Great Britain. Such being the case, what is the opinion of the whole North? Finnish diplomatic sources found this news extremely hard to take. They said that the spirit in which their answer was given and the content should, in their opinion, have been satisfactory to the British. True, they said, it was based on the hopes that the two democracies would have faith in Finland's word, that she would soon cease her military action. They point out that the Russians, out of most of the former Finnish positions, the time when Finland could end her direct military action was near at hand. But on the other hand, they said it was impossible for the Finnish army to stop now, with one leg literally hanging in midair. Stockholm government and political circles expressed very much the same attitude. Up to the last, realizing the differences existing between Finland, Great Britain, and the United States, these circles still held on to the hope that the Finnish answer would be satisfactory to the British. Meanwhile, in Helsinki, the Finns are celebrating their Independence Day. What was to have been a festive occasion has been blackened by the news that they are now involved in a great war. Less than a half hour ago, I tried to speak with President Ritti, but he was just putting the final touches to his speech to the Finnish people, which he will deliver this afternoon. This is David Anderson returning you now to NBC in New York.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Now, before we go abroad again, here's news of other capitals reported from the newsroom in New York. Rome. The Italian government called more men to the colors today for regular military service. This call brings in young men born in 1923. Berlin. A German military spokesman says a new phase of operations is beginning in North Africa, but the development is not sufficiently advanced to see what form it is taking. He says both sides are active and trying to control the initiative. From Rome, the Italians tell of sharp fighting between the advanced British and fascist units in the Bir el Gobi area of the Libyan front. That's about 40 miles south of Tobruk, and no indication of the direction the battle is taking is offered. Bad weather is said to have restricted aerial operations in the desert battle zone, but Italian fighters claim to have shot down 13 British aircraft, and German pilots are credited with bagging two more. Now, the British capital is the next point on this roundup of news. So, go ahead, London.
This is London. John McBain speaking. Britain will be officially at war with Finland, Hungary, and Romania at 1 minute past midnight, Greenwich time tonight. British official notes were sent to the three countries during the night and will be delivered today by the American ministers in the three capitals. The Romanian and Hungarian governments didn't reply to Britain's final demand before midnight last night, the deadline. The Finns did answer, but made it clear that Finland had no intention of complying with the British demand that Finland cease waging an aggressive war against Russia. The British have tried to get Finland to call off their invasion of Russia, but the participation of the Finns in the recent anti-Comintern pact meeting in Berlin seems to have been the final indication that Finland was out not to defend herself, but to get as much territory from Russia as she could while the getting was good. Diplomatic relations between Britain and the three Axis satellites have been broken for some time. It's reported here today that about 200 nationals of the three countries have been rounded up in Britain and will be interned. From Czechoslovak quarters today, it was learned that the Czechoslovak government considers itself at war with the three powers, although no official statement has been issued. These quarters point out that all enemies of Britain and Russia are enemies of Czechoslovakia. Military quarters in London today had no fresh information on the Libyan situation. So much publicity has been given here of the Dominion troops in action in the Middle East that the average Britisher has been wondering whether any British troops were involved in the campaign. Today, military circles stated that most of the troops in Libya are from Britain, and the armored formations are entirely British. It was stated here today that the German main offensive on the Russian front is now about 40 miles west of Moscow, between Dmitrov and the Leningrad Road. The British press has carried full reports of the disclosure of an alleged secret army plan, American army plan. Naturally, there's no official comment here on the matter. If you talk with British Army leaders about future plans of the British Army in various parts of the world, they say that military strategists in London are constantly at work on many military plans that cover possible activities in just about every part of the globe. These plans are changed as the military situation changes. The idea seems to be that if something new happens, say, for instance, Japan attacks Australia or Russia collapses, the military leaders in London won't have to suddenly say, "What can we do about this?" Instead, they haul out Plan X or Plan Y, which has figured out details of what is to be done, and orders go out to change Army, Navy, and Air Force plans all over the empire. To some observers here, the reported American plan seems of a type similar to these British plans. That is, a scheme worked out to provide for possible action if circumstances ever make it necessary. The Yorkshire Post today says, "No one with any knowledge of the world will be surprised that the American authorities have considered many possibilities. Some of them unlikely, but still possibilities." The paper goes on to point out that America is firmly resolved on the overthrow of Hitler and is cooperating with Britain and Russia. What part should most properly be assigned to each of these three great powers is not easy to settle once and for all, the Yorkshire Post adds. Great Britain is doing her part by fighting a common enemy in Libya and by supplying arms for his overthrow in Russia. Russia at the moment is engaged 100% on one function only, that of fighting. The Americans are also engaged on one function only, that of supplying arms. But the functions best discharged by each of these powers may come to change in time. The Post explains that Britain won't hesitate to shift more of her effort from the factory to the field when this becomes necessary, and says it would be common sense for the United States to envisage a similar change. "We hope to win the war without needing an American expeditionary force in Europe," the article concludes. "But such a victory may not be within our powers. The United States government is bound to prepare for what may be." This is John McBain in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. To complete our picture of world events at this hour, we switch next to Earl Godwin, speaking from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Finland is very popular in the United States and in Congress. The fact that England will declare a state of war against Finland is being taken here in rather gloomy fashion. It will probably be a much more of a stumbling block in future lend-lease policies and appropriations than the purported AEF. However, the net result of the Japanese maneuvering replying to the president that they're putting troops into Indochina to match a Chinese force is to give the world more time before an actual clash. That's the net result here. Labor legislation will precipitate as much of a fight in the Senate as it did in the House before that drastic Smith anti-strike bill passed overwhelmingly. Chances seem to favor a more moderate Senate bill, and the Senate starts labor debating on Monday. These items are the principal items of the routine news. The real story, I think, is the progress of defense, because the House passed another $8.25 billion arms and defense bill, putting the total of our proposed expenditures in defense and lease lends since the fall of France to $67 billion. The suspicion that the administration plans to invade Europe with a 5-million-man American expeditionary force was thoroughly debated yesterday afternoon, but AEF or not, the House voted 309-5 for this further huge contribution to the defense of the nation and the defeat of the Axis and world freedom. However, isolationists insist that the administration shall disclose its war plans, and despite the fact that Army and Navy staff previews contain vital military secrets, there seems to be a slender minority on Capitol Hill that seems to want to bring all this out right on the front stoop where potential enemies can take a look. Senator Wheeler of Montana, in his own state last night, predicted this country will send a small army to Britain and Northern Ireland by next spring, and will send a complete expeditionary force to Africa, possibly to Europe, by July 1943. The congressional appropriations start industry on its way for an all-out production, but no brief broadcast can explain the tremendous obstacle race American industry is conducting all the time, and no broadcast can list the obstacles encountered, even by a few of the smart American managers. An airplane factory, for instance, had to expand further and could not expand without more roads to carry additional workers to and from the plants. No other way of getting there. The Glenn Martin Company, near here, for instance, was called on to build one of the biggest fleet of biggest airships ever, and it had to call for more and more workers, and then had to build 600 homes in which to house this new army of workmen. That's going on, of course, all the time. We're familiar with it. It's a story which is multiplied 1,000 times over, being taken care of in the same American manner that the pioneers whose plows first broke the plains had to take care of the opposition forces of nature and the Indians. You just can't break into the promised land without effort, no matter who tells you differently. But already American industry has delivered to the government $10 billion worth of defense equipment, which is more than had even been ordered 9 months ago. A year ago, shell loading was an art known only to 10 men in the United States. Today, two huge plants are loading shells, and a third plant is being built, and I understand there's a strike in one of those two plants. Steel output had been increased nearly 6 million tons a year, and the aluminum industry is getting close to four times its 1940 production. Of course, mass production of war material is being reached, but it's entirely by entirely different methods than those methods which we have used for a generation for the home articles of the piping times of peace. And that's all from Washington at this time.
With that report from Earl Godwin, we end our news report this morning. Other speakers were David Anderson from Stockholm and John McVane from London. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The popular Russian ambassador, best known figure of the Soviet Russian government to the American public, has kindly consented to say a few words informally to the great audience of National Broadcasting Company, and to put cream in the coffee, so to speak, or I suppose a Russian might say, to put lemon in the tea. Mrs. Litvinov, who is very much a personage in her own right, is going to join in. Mr. Litvinov, when were you last in the United States?
8 years ago. Exactly. 1933.
Well, now I'm going to ask Mrs. Litvinov a question. Mrs. Litvinov is by birth an Englishwoman. It will interest you to know that. Mrs. Litvinov, did you like your flight across India and the Pacific?
Yes, I enjoyed it very much. But I shall be glad when it's quite over.
I don't blame you. Well, I can assure you that the weather from here on to Washington, D.C. is likely to be very smooth. I came last night from there.
I'm sure you'd see to that for us.
You have a lot of confidence in us.
I certainly have. I think the Victory Geese was your idea too, wasn't it?
Oh, no, indeed. I've got testimony for that. They're right ahead of your plane.
No, I saw them.
Oh, but you saw them too.
I think you organized them, didn't you?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, while you were coming across from the continent, I was trying to think of things to ask you and the ambassador that wouldn't be too political. And that's not very easy to do, because after all, we're interested in your political mission. But, you know, the American people are very curious. And, Mr. Litvinov, what really happened in Persia when the plane went off without you?
We had a very pleasant trip. I would rather try to forget small unpleasantness which happened during that long trip of nearly 20,000 miles.
I see. Well, that's
covered 3/4 of the globe in coming to the States.
That's right. Well, that's a very nice statement of you to make anyhow. I recall seeing Mrs. Litvinov in Moscow back in 1928. And I wonder if she would tell us something about Moscow at war today. Just a few words, Mrs. Litvinov. Could you come right close?
How can I say something about Moscow at war today in a few words? It's rather a large order, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. But give us an impression.
Well, I've been a month away from Moscow. When I left, there was a hard frost and deep snow. And I hope it's still harder and still deeper. That's all I can say.
I see. Well, thank you so much. Now for the ambassador. Ambassador, would you say a word about Soviet Russia's fight against Hitler? Something like you told us a few minutes ago.
I can only assure the American people that the armed forces of the Soviet Union will continue the fight against the foe of mankind, Hitler, with the same heroism and fairness which have already earned the recognition of the whole world.
Ambassador, there's a pause here. Do you look forward with pleasure to your work in Washington?
I'm looking forward with great pleasure and confidence to my work in Washington, especially to my talks with your great president, of whom I have the most pleasant reminiscences since my first arrival to this country.
Yeah. And you have a very good personal acquaintance with our Secretary of State, I believe, Cordell Hull.
Yes, I'm sure we shall work hand in hand.
Well, now for the question that comes perhaps closest to us here, Ambassador. You have just flown the Pacific. You have talked with people in India, Burma, Malaya, the Philippines, and elsewhere. I wonder what was your impression upon meeting American influence on the opposite side of the Pacific, 8,000 miles from Treasure Island here?
I have seen many representatives, both of Great Britain and the United States, military, naval, and civil. I wish first of all to express to them my gratitude for the kindness and hospitality they've shown us all along the way. Of course, I carry with me very many impressions, but I have not yet digested them. I must have some time.
You'll see that Ambassador Litvinov, folks, is a very cautious diplomat, as well as a very genial one. He's been most kindly in answering questions asked him here by the newspaper men. Right now, we Americans are wondering, Ambassador, whether we will have peace or war in the Pacific. But whether we do one or the other, tell us this in closing. What part is Russia prepared to play in the future of the Pacific?
I'm afraid I can't at the present moment make any statements of political nature.
The Ambassador feels that's a statement of the political nature, which he doesn't want to make here. But I'm sure we're all most pleased to have heard from the Ambassador in this genial fashion. And I want Mrs. Litvinov to say goodbye till next time on the mic to the American people, because I have a hunch she's going to be in front of the mic a good many times here in America.
No, I'm not. Goodbye.
Goodbye to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. From the Pan American Airways waiting room on Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay, we brought you an interview with Soviet Ambassador Maksim Lipinov and Mrs. Lipinov, as conducted by Upton Close, the National Broadcasting Company's expert on affairs of the Far East and the Pacific. Mr. Close was sent from the NBC newsroom in New York to specially greet Ambassador and Mrs. Lipinov on their arrival here in continental America. There were others here, too, from the East to greet them. Andrei Gromyko, the Chargé d'Affaires in Washington, General Alexander Ripin of the Russian Military Mission, Konstantin Lukashov, New York Office of AMTORG, and Colonel Ilya Saryev, the Acting Military Attaché in Washington, D.C., as well as Kenneth Durand of the TASS News Agency in New York. These men will fly back with Ambassador and Mrs. Lipinov to New York and Washington. This, then, is the National Broadcasting Company.